You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the latest Times Higher Education Books podcast, where we focus on our book of the week. This week's book of the week is Sex and Buildings, Modern Architecture and the Sexual Revolution. And I'm delighted to say that I have the author of this delicious book in the studio. My guest today is Richard J. Williams, Professor of Visual Cultures at the University of Edinburgh. Richard, thank you for coming in.
Well, thank you for inviting me. It's not often you have a book described as delicious, but that's very, very nice to hear.
Well, you know, I'm sure that there's an advantage to putting the word sex in very big letters on the cover of your book.
It helps, yeah.
But obviously, people are very interested in sex, and they're quite interested in buildings as well. But when I started reading this book, I was a bit surprised to see that you're rather an outlier with this title. There aren't a lot of books aimed at the thoughtful general reader on this subject.
Yeah, that's a very good question, and it's part of the rationale for writing the book, in that there wasn't really anything much out there. If you start to think about this question, you think, well, you know, most of us have sex at one point or other in our lives, and for the most part we have sex in buildings, and the relationship between the two is quite an intimate one, that we often think that our sexual lives are conditioned by buildings in some way. We might remember particular rooms or places, or there are all kinds of associations, so that it's something that we routinely work with. But the place where that's discussed is rarely very, very public. So if you look at what architects say about buildings, well, curiously, they don't really talk about sex at all, or I think it's a residue of, a kind of suspicion or an uneasiness about the body, in a way. So if you read the architectural press, really of any time, or listen to architects talk, they're much more comfortable, for the most part, talking about buildings as two-dimensional aesthetic objects. They're much less comfortable about the idea of people inhabiting buildings.
People are messy, inconvenient.
They are, and in fact, when it comes to having buildings photographed. I have a big file of clippings of architects complaining about photographers putting people in buildings, and it's something that has very routinely been said, that they don't really like people to be photographed inhabiting buildings. I can understand that from an artistic or aesthetic point of view, that you've made something nice, you don't want it messed up.
Cluttered up with teacups and people's jumpers and desks.
Precisely, but you don't really, it doesn't really account for the fact that buildings have to exist in the world and buildings are inhabited by people. And so I think the sex question really comes down to that, actually. The whole discourse of architecture, the conventions of architecture, the way that people talk about architecture at a professional level is very uncomfortable with bodies.
Is it also because presumably a lot of where sex goes on is in a domestic space, and that's not valorized in the same way as large public buildings? You know, vernacular architecture is thought of as being all very nice in its way, but Let's face it, a giant tower is more interesting than a cottage.
No, well, actually, cottage is
yes,
a difficult.
You discuss
be careful.
In the book the,
well,
the use of the term cottaging.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's also a very good point. I think for the most part, when we think about the spaces that we might have our sexual lives played out in, they're domestic, they're ordinary, they're things that architects probably haven't been involved with too much. It may be just a tiny percentage at the top end, if you can afford to have an architect design some spectacular bedroom. But for the most part, these are spaces that are off the radar. So that's also important. And, it has a gender dimension to it as well.
You talk in the book about the suburbs being an essentially feminine space. And, of course, they're a domestic space as well.
Yeah.
You begin by saying, what might sexually liberated architecture look like? And this book is a journey as well as, and the idea of a journey as a narrative is not that common in academic work compared to, say, going around Ireland with a fridge or or travel writing.
Yeah.
And there are elements of that in this book. Did you find out what sexually liberated architecture looks like? It seems to me that, you know, you investigate many forms in this book, but when we come to the end of the book, you do say perhaps outward forms of place had nothing to do with the sexual lives it framed. Mm. So was your journey wasted?
It's a slightly depressing conclusion in a way. I mean,
I've given it away. I'm sorry.
Well, you
that,
have.
That's
you
been
have.
A spoiler.
But that's what academics do, don't they? They say right at the beginning of an article, they tell you exactly what they're going to say, and then they say it. But the conclusion is slightly downbeat in a way. I think it's an accurate conclusion at this point in time, but it is slightly downbeat. And the straight answer is no. I didn't in my travels find something that existed as some kind of ideal. I saw things that maybe could have stood in for that, and I spent a lot of time in California.
And mid-century modern is your area of interest, and America was.
Well, I thought, yeah,
in
I mean,
this
I,
book, and America I, was your focus. For
absolutely,
those
I mean, I felt, you know, very drawn to mid-century U.S. and U.S. architecture, and particularly California. It seemed that there, on a very public level, there were a whole set of things that were played out and discussed, and they were there in the newspapers, and there was a great popular interest in that. But in terms of producing an architecture that really did frame a different kind of sexual life, I didn't really find that. And I must say, my experience of Los Angeles, although it's a city that I know pretty well and like a great deal, but my experience is that it's a city that works incredibly hard and in fact has little time for anything else. But, you know, that may be my impression of it.
To what extent was it that you were looking at some quite famous buildings by renowned modernist architects and designers, but that was an era in which there was a lot of thinking about the body and a lot of thinking about human beings, but it seemed quite Puritan, as you point out, in a lot of ways. So it wasn't hedonist, it wasn't Baroque, it wasn't Versailles. Mm. I think a lot of people would associate sexy architecture maybe with decadent phases, and the modernism that you're looking at, it seemed like it wasn't the kind of place where you'd be lounging around up to no good.
or lots of good, depending on your point of view. I mean, that is something that needs to be clarified, I think. There's a strand of modernism that is decidedly puritanical. There's no question about that. And I think the modernism that we tended to inherit here in the UK, if we're thinking about this context, tended to be that very puritanical strand. It could only really speak about the life of buildings in terms of efficiency.
Well, machines for living, that doesn't sound sexy.
Not really. Well, I mean, it depends what kind of machine, but no, basically you're right. But then at the same time, there are strands of modernism which are much more acknowledging of the body.
The display of the body, as you talk about.
And it's my starting point, really, as well as the US, but it was certainly Brazil. And I'd done...
You've written about Brazil and you've...
Yeah, and I spent, you know, probably a good part of the last 10 years doing stuff in relation to Brazil in one way or another, and I got to know... I got to know the canonical sites of Brazilian modernism pretty well.
And we think of Brazil as being a place where Oscar
Niemeyer,
and warm climate, gorgeous bodies, must be a sexy place, and they've got some nice buildings. So is that where sex and buildings gets it together?
It was certainly a starting point. There's a couple of things to say about Brazil. One is that Le Corbusier, who had started out with a rather puritanical, efficiency-oriented...
got the impression he would like to tell people how to run their sex lives.
Exactly. There's something rather dictatorial about his work. He goes to Brazil in the late 20s. He does two trips. I think the first is 1929. Although somebody will correct me now. It's in the book.
Please write in if it was December 1928.
He does a couple of trips to Brazil and in fact has a kind of erotic epiphany in Brazil. And in the first trip, actually disappears.
Like a lot of Northerners.
Well, indeed, yeah. I mean, he's middle-aged, terribly settled, respectable, and in fact disappears for 2 weeks in Rio. Nobody knows where he goes to. He comes back with a...
The library?
I don't think so, somehow. And he comes back with a great sheaf of drawings, which I have copies of them, for him, terribly exotic Brazilian women on the beach.
Really? Pictures of women on the beach? Yeah.
And in fact, if you go through his sketchbooks for his period in Brazil, there's far more sketches of women on the beach than there are of any architecture. And yet, what he's best known for is a megalomaniac plan for Rio, where he proposes demolishing it and replacing it with a kind of 6-story megastructure.
The ladies obviously would somehow be involved.
Somehow. I mean, Corbusier is important, and that's pretty well known. Nehemiah and his circle of friends in Rio took up something of Corbusier's work and eroticized it in lots of ways. They could see something that could be done. I met Nehemiah must be about 10 years ago. I interviewed him in his studio in Copacabana, and he was terribly charming. But what he wanted to talk about was how beautiful Brazilian women were, how nice the beach was. He talked about his life. He got up, did a few sketches, sat at a beach cafe, and drew sketches of women in latest bathing costumes. And that is basically what he wanted to talk about. So there's something there, but it's a rather cliched thing. And it's important to recognise that's a very high-end, very refined, officially sanctioned sort of architecture. To what extent that filters down to how the rest of us live, well, it doesn't for the most part.
And lower down the scale, you mention in the book, you discuss love hotels in both Japan and Brazil, and there are reasons why these, and obviously, as you mentioned, a lot of times when people think of sex in buildings, they think of having it in hotels.
Yeah.
What is the reason that love hotels are so popular or were so popular in both those countries?
Yeah, I actually first came across the love hotel in Spain when I lived there in the early 90s, and Madrid had quite a few of them, and it was I must say I wasn't really a patron of these establishments, but I was curious about them and people would tell me about them. It comes down basically to a set of circumstances involving rapid urbanization, small living spaces, probably a desperate need to find space. And in Madrid, there was a particular set of issues around rapid urbanization and space. It was very common, in fact, still is very common, for grown-up children to be still living with their parents.
Hence the need for somewhere to go and have a little privacy.
Exactly. So, and it's exactly the same set of circumstances that you got in 60s, 70s, 80s Brazil and Japan as well, although played out in a slightly different way. I think fundamentally they're a very good idea, actually. And I think, given that we're sitting here in the middle of central London.
London, small living space.
London really is sort of re-urbanising in a quite a dramatic and rapid way. It does seem to me that it probably could do with some facilities like that.
Now, you had a few strange experiences in the course of the journeys for this book. The one that sticks with me is your visit to the world of Wilhelm Reich sitting inside one of his orgone accumulators at Organon in Maine. For those who haven't read the book, tell us a little bit about the orgone accumulator and why it freaked you out.
I quite like the orgone accumulator, but it did also freak me out. Reich was a pupil and later colleague of Freud's in Vienna, and a kind of maverick psychoanalyst. And his shtick really was that if we all had more sex and more satisfying sex, then we would all be happier. And in particular, he was convinced that fascism was a product of
sexual frustration.
All
those blonde boys in black leather, as someone else in your
book
mentioned.
Philip Johnson, yeah. yes, I think there may be a few flaws in Wright's argument, but anyway, he's an important figure. And the writing, until the early 40s, his writing is pretty compelling in all sorts of ways. He says things which even now sound quite forward.
And then there were the orgone accumulators.
Yeah, the orgone theory. Orgone is O-R-G-O-N-E. Orgone is a theory of cosmic energy, completely unproven, I'm afraid. But it's the idea is that it suffuses everything, and that it is particularly manifest at the point of orgasm. So it's a linking of the body and the cosmos in a kind of spiritual soup. Really hard to explain. You need to read the stuff. The
sounds orgone, a bit damp, actually.
Yeah, it does a bit. The orgone accumulator is a very simple structure. It's a box made of wood lined with metal. It's about the size of a large refrigerator.
I was going to say, you do look like you're sitting in a refrigerator.
Yeah.
You don't look like you're at one with the universe.
I wasn't at all at one with the universe. You sit in it. It's very cold to the touch, and aficionados of the accumulator would sit in it. In fact, stripped, naked, they'd close the door and sit in darkness, and it would supposedly charge them up, so full of orgone energy, which would put them in a good place to have a satisfying sexual life.
Is this wildly different from flotation tanks?
not really. No, I think in the end, there's no question that it is odd, and my experience was of, first time round, nothing much happening. Second time around, sitting in darkness. I should say clothed actually, but sitting in darkness.
You are clothed in the picture. I
am. Waiting for something to happen, but also actually just suddenly feeling very alarmed.
You were there by yourself,
yeah.
In this,
and it's an extremely remote location in Maine, and it did all get a bit too much. Actually, I just had to leave. But I do like Reich's early writings. I think that there's a number of very simple points that he makes, and I must say that the Reich Museum and the Institute, it's wonderfully, it's a beautiful place, it's very peaceful, but it is very, very strange.
You may not need to sit inside the fridge.
I don't think so.
One of your other experiences was peeing at the Commerzbank in Frankfurt.
I have to say, I never actually peed at the Commerzbank.
Oh, you didn't? No. Well, there's a great picture that will
show
those of you who use urinals. Will discover that if they go to the Commerzbank in Frankfurt, they can look down on the city while having a wee. I think even non-academic experts can work out what the dynamic is there.
Exactly, yeah. No, I never actually visited the urinal, and I think I've seen the Commerzbank several times, but never made it into to the exalted level of the transparent bathroom, which is right at the top of the building. I think it's only the chief head of the CEO, the top brass, really get to do that.
No indication about what when the CEO is a woman, what opportunities there will be.
I have
to
no idea. I suspect that didn't really cross the architect's mind there. Yeah.
So you also discuss in the book something that I think any of us can think of and feel a little bit silly, that tower blocks, giant, tall buildings are quite phallic. Is there much more to say?
The straight answer is no. I don't think there is, but I felt that it was important to cover that ground.
And to give us a picture of the brick dick in Ypsilanti, Michigan.
It was a good pretext to do that, because this was it's a water tower built in the, I think it was the late 19th century, in Ypsilanti, Michigan, which is a very small college town, not that far from Detroit. And I happened to be in Detroit, and I drove out there to have a look at it. It was voted by Cabinet magazine, which is a very nice culture magazine, the world's most phallic building. I couldn't believe that it was the world's most phallic building, but having seen the so-called brick dick, I can assure everybody listening that it really is. It's the most remarkable looking thing. I mean, it's difficult to describe in words.
Fortunately, in the world of Google, it's only a click away for everyone.
It is.
And I have to say that we immediately found a picture. And
what
were they thinking?
What were they thinking? I think that the part of the shock of it, let's say, is the fact that Ypsilanti is so small. So that every other building in Ypsilanti is a one or two story
it's
house.
It's not in the middle of the city like the Gherkin is here.
Far from it. It's there. It is by far the biggest structure and by far the most vertical structure. And not only is it big and vertical, but it is astonishingly phallic looking.
Now, when you were in LA, when you talk about some of the buildings there, you use the term porno modernism to talk about some of the buildings that we come across. Mm. John Lautner's building for James Goldstein, the famous cowboy hatted habitué of the front row of fashion shows. Mm. And it's a beautiful house. Lautner, I found it very interesting. You talked about Lautner being essentially cut out of the mainstream of the respectable architect's world, and so although he didn't really like it, he ended up being valorized by Playboy magazine, which wrote a lot about architecture in a sort of your James Bond pad kind of way.
Absolutely.
Why were these buildings, other than the fact that they were extremely modern and extremely expensive, why would you say these buildings are sexy in that sense, other than that you imagine some superbly wealthy man who can have all the women he wants?
Yeah, well, that's Goldstein. I should say that particular house was commissioned
for
Helen Sheets.
Right. And then Goldstein picked it up later, and Lautner helped him take the building back to the state it had originally been in.
Apparently. I mean, I forget the story exactly, but it's got quite a complicated history. Yeah. But anyway, I mean, get back to the larger
buildings?
Point. Yeah, I do actually think they are sexy. In that they have a number of devices in them that are just very specifically designed for pleasure of one kind or another. So the Sheets Goldstein house has a number of bathrooms which are, you know, either transparent or they're highly mirrored. They have a really public dimension to them. I mean, what one of them, I was taken around by one of Goldstein's entourage. I mean, really sort of charming woman who showed me, pointed out all of the things I might be interested in, but she said this bathroom, pointing to a thing that was completely lined in mirrors. She said, "This really is the bathroom from hell." which was good, but
I suppose it depends what you find sexy. Obviously, if it's the gaze, as scholars like to talk about, it could be great. If you want a bit of peace and quiet,
indeed. I mean, I think that's a very good point. Actually, you know, if you want privacy, if you want darkness, secrecy, whatever, well, you're not going to have a Lautner house. Although that said, that there are actually lots of nooks and crannies there, but there are lots of games that he plays with, seeing and being seen and hiding and being visible, that kind of thing. So the one thing that's perhaps worth giving as a really clear example is the master bedroom in that house is built essentially underneath or just to the side of the swimming pool, and it has big glass windows looking into the pool. So the idea is that, you know, there you are in bed and you can see people swimming around in the pool. I mean, it's pretty obvious.
Were people just really marked by Esther Williams films, do you think? Was is that the unspoken element in all this?
It may be, and you know, who knows how these things were commissioned. Well, I mean, you can dig around and find all sorts of things.
So it points to some kind of, you know, our cliched idea of Hollywood decadence and badly behaved parties. And
yeah, I mean, Lautner's stuff really is decadent. So it draws on modernism, but really it is it's very exaggerated. It has really nothing to do with early 20th century European modernism. It's turned into something else altogether. But the curious thing, which you alluded to, is that Lautner himself hated speaking in those terms. I mean, as far as he was concerned, he was interested in the natural world and buildings that approach the condition of the forest or nature.
Right,
or
his Norwegian background that you mention in the book.
Exactly.
So do you find these things, these buildings that you cite as examples of porno-modernism, are they an affront to you as an aesthetically-minded person?
I like them. No, like them. I mean, I think Lautner and, I mean, to pick a slightly different example, John Portman, the hotel architect, I think their stuff is great because they deal fairly explicitly with the idea that people have bodies and needs and want pleasure and things like that. Lautner, he tended to articulate it in terms of this back to nature thing, but there's no question that he was a bodily person. I mean, that sounds ridiculous, but there's no question that he was interested in the body, and the way that he talks about his background, his childhood, it's full of all sorts of physical things. I mean, even at the most in some of the most refined things that he says, he's talking about swimming in lakes in Michigan and that sort of thing. These are very bodily things. Portman, the the architect is essentially responsible for the atrium form of the hotel, much criticised, much disliked by the more refined part of architecture. I think he's fantastic in recognising that people are much more than a pair of eyes, and they're going to want to have different kinds of experiences, and that he's actually one of very few architects who's quite happy to have his buildings photographed in use. Very
so
rare.
That aesthetic end, as well as aesthetic end of architecture, that they don't want people in the buildings, beautiful clean lines, maybe very triumphant, very dominant, which could be stereotypically heterosexual male, obviously, it's wonderful that in the book you talk about the fountainhead when you think of dubiously sexy architects in literature. It begins and ends there. Is that the reason why there aren't books such as this one already, or why thinking of sex and buildings would need to come from someone, say, outside the academic architecture world? You're not an academic of architecture, but of art history, the visual world. You said to me earlier that you more or less, had to think of a title for your academic post because it's not always easy to define what it is. But could you imagine a book like this being written by someone who was in an architecture department?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's no reason why not. It's just I'm very close to architecture, actually, in Edinburgh. I mean, I'm in the same building and I teach architecture students and so on. But there's no question that the way that I think about things is slightly slightly offbeat as far as the mainstream architecture teaching tends to go. I mean, so I think I've been able to think some slightly different and sometimes slightly heretical thoughts, and from an architecture point of view, there are things that I no doubt don't say and possibly get wrong, or I emphasise different things and prioritise perhaps the wrong stuff, and so on. And there are different ways to write this, but I think it at the moment, with the way that architectural discourse is, and in fact, more broadly, the way that discourses around sexuality are, it's probably only likely to happen from a a slightly weird perspective, or certainly an interdisciplinary perspective rather than a strictly disciplinary one.
And oddly enough, your perspective as a straight man is a sort of minority report in this kind of studying. Our reviewer, the review that you've not seen yet, pointed out that many of the people writing about this are women or gay men or gay women, and that one of the things that was so exciting and refreshing about this book, other than a personal framing, was that it was written by someone who is unabashedly saying that some of their perspective is coloured by the fact of being a man and a straight man. I suppose there will be some people who will be outraged that it should be necessary to even say that, that things have changed so much.
Yeah, well, I'm so glad you brought this up, actually. This is a really good question, because I think where I come from, that experience has become, in a peculiar way, a sort of minority position. It's in terms of experience, no, of course, it's not a minority position, but in terms of the way that sexuality has been explored or theorized or problematized or discussed, it is a sort of minority position, and it is also one that's full of contradictions and problems. Now, I spent a lot of my the early part of my academic career in Manchester, which is a city I know extremely well, and the latter few years I was there, then I spent a lot of time on Canal Street. I did most of my drinking down there, and it existed in quite a fluid world. Although I didn't really participate in that apart from just drinking and socialising.
And it's known as being a gay village.
Should say that. I mean, it's one of the most, it's one of the largest and most public sort of gay zones of any city, certainly in the UK, but Europe, the world actually. And that was, it was just fascinating and wonderful to see all that. And it seemed to me that there were all kinds of things that were being worked out and explored there to do with, let's say, monogamy, polyamory, how were you going to live? How were you going to live but also have a sexually satisfying life?
It wasn't, and sexuality in the public realm as well.
Exactly, yeah. All of those things. Likewise, feminist discourses feminist experiences, whatever, have done an enormous amount to explore those things. And the literatures are huge and fascinating and rich. I felt, and this was my experience really is confirmed by that of lots of other people that I know, that if you're in what used to be a kind of normal frame of my own life, could not be more respectable and normal in lots of ways. Two children, cats, married, but whatever. But the things that have been worked out and troubled and explored in other areas for other groups have not really been explored there. So what happens if we're all living to 80, 85, 90? That our health is good. We're brought up to expect that sexuality is a good thing. It's a natural part of our lives, that we can expect to have sex for pleasure as well as for procreation. What happens to those things in a context when they run up against the demands of childcare and monogamy and also a general sense of I can't think of anybody in my in similar circumstances. I can't think of any of my male friends who would not want somehow to be completely respectful of their female companions, their wives, partners, whatever. There's no sense of that they would be comfortable in dominating their partners in an old-fashioned way. I mean, I can't think of the words exactly, but you can see what I'd say. I mean, the, if you to go back a generation or two, the idea that a partner's feelings might not matter.
Which is why Mad Men, which you discuss in the book, the frisson of us seeing something that seems so alien to us now, has that power.
That's right. I mean, the it's perhaps the most startling thing about Mad Men is how badly women get treated in there. Lots of other complex things going on. And now, clearly, women do get badly treated, but there's sort of men also get badly treated. But it, I think for in, if you're... In a middle class academic perspective, I mean the idea that it might be acceptable in some way to not respect a female partner's feelings. I mean, it's just horrifying. I mean, utterly horrifying. And that's a big change from how things were a generation or two back. But I don't think these things have all been worked out. There are many things in the mix now which are very complex.
Maybe I'd like to conclude by saying one of the things I found most refreshing about the book, and as you've pointed out, you're not the only scholar to do so, but that you brought into the work not only your perspective as an academic who is many things but is also a straight white man, but that you began and ended by talking about your own neighbourhood, Morningside, and reflecting on the environment you lived in and how you thought about its impact on people. You begin by saying, you know, you could see why people would be sexually frustrated living in a bourgeois, respectable place like this, and you end by saying, who knows what's going on behind closed doors? Was that your olive branch to the outraged neighbours of Morningside?
Yeah, well, the neighbours have been very quiet. I don't think they have. I don't think they've noticed yet. Although I was I did a fringe event last week where one of the people in the audience was the chair of the Morningside Community Council. But and she was pretty terrifying. But actually. She didn't know anything about this book.
says some lovely things about the neighbourhood if she's listening, I think.
I think the bottom line in the end is that people will do what they do regardless of the buildings, and that when sex needs to happen or when there is, you know, real desire, it's going to happen regardless of the circumstances. However, if we accept that that sexuality is pretty central to the kinds of lives that we want to live, and that we should be fairly open about it and be able to talk about it, then I do think we ought to build in a slightly different way. We ought to build in a way that somehow acknowledges that. And my remarks about Morningside were really about not just the form of the building, which is... essentially, this is a 19th century neighbourhood with a very marked demarcation between public and private, and inside and outside. My remarks about it were really, partly to say the outward form does say something about sexual attitudes, but it's also the fact that outward form is still valued in some ways does strike me as being peculiar. You know, here we are 2013, and that it is still seen somehow as an ideal when we could build differently. I mean, that's a big question, but it is curious that we want to reiterate these, to my mind, rather archaic forms. It would be nice to be able to experiment.
On the other hand, there's something to be said for things going on, in the words of the song, behind closed doors. Some of the homes you mentioned that have viewing platforms and so on, obviously that would take a different approach to sexuality, but is there not a part of you responding personally that thinks, actually, somewhere a little bit cozier might be? There must be a reason why that has been favoured.
Yeah, well, indeed. I mean, I think... There's a part of me that completely understands that. You know, you need privacy. You need to be able to hide away. But there's also a part of me that slightly regrets that that's the case somehow.
Right.
That I wish we lived in a set of circumstances that was a bit more open about things. Let me put it that way. So instead of assuming or desiring that sexuality has to be played out in private, that it could be played out in a slightly more public way. I think that's what I liked about Canal Street, to be honest. You know,
it doesn't require California weather. Requires a different approach.
Yes, different mindset. I mean, Manchester's climate is hardly the greatest in the world, and and yet, you know, the people are out and they're enjoying themselves.
My guest today has been Richard J. Williams, author of Sex in Buildings, Modern Architecture and the Sexual Revolution. Richard, thanks for stopping by.
Thank you. Great pleasure.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.